Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. We've been on a bit of a summer break for this pod, but luckily not too much has happened in our absence, I don't think. Just the Euros, huge transfers and the start of the new season, not too much at all. With me to chew the fat on it all today, three of my usual compadres on such occasions. We've got both sides of the city of Liverpool represented today, divided not just by Stanley Park, but potentially on their feelings towards one Rafa Benitez too. We shall see on that score. In the blue corner, we've got Paul McParlin. How are you doing, Paul?
Doing well, Aidan, and thanks for inviting me on the show. It's always a pleasure to be involved in this podcast. I absolutely love it. Thank you.
Oh, not at all. We always love having you on it, Paul. And in the red corner, the yin to your yang, is Stephen Scragg. How are you doing there, Stephen?
We're doing very well, Aidan. We're doing very well. Looking forward to this. Always a joy to be on this cousin of the Big Brother podcast.
And bring a little bit of balance to things, which is not something we normally associate with Man United, but we've got the Man United fan to sit in between our two arguing Liverpoolians. Stephen Bell, how are you doing there, Stephen?
Yeah, good day, thanks. Yes, back to being a United fan now. I've made a conscious decision to be a little bit more enthusiastic and not as judgmental. So that's why I'm sat here in my new shirt now.
I think it does make for an interesting demographic for this podcast. You know, the concept of, you know, a Liverpool fan, an Everton fan, and a Man United fan walking to a pub. It has the you know, the perfect beginning of what should be an absolutely brilliant joke.
And the Newcastle fan playing referee. Yeah.
See if we can think of a punchline before the end. Well, before we look ahead to the Premier League season, which is underway, of course, we'll look back briefly, first of all. We've done various podcasts on These Football Times ahead of the Euros earlier this summer, but we haven't reflected on it at all together since then. So, firstly, a bit of a look back. Primarily, before we get into England and anything like that, was it any good is my key question here. How will history judge this tournament? Obviously, it was different for a whole host of reasons, you know, the current situation being one, but it was a multi-host tournament as well, and all the issues that brought, all the travelling, and then throwing the fact that some places had fans, some didn't, and so on. It was a bit of a strange tournament. Paul, coming to you first, how do you think history will judge Euro 2020 brackets one?
Well, I think realistically, it's probably a bit too early to decide how history would judge the competition, say, only finished 2 months ago. But I think given the special, unique circumstances under which it takes place, with the background of the COVID pandemic, I think it'll be judged reasonably sympathetically. I think that's the only way you can look at it. I was lucky enough to go to two games myself. I went to the Croatia-Czech Republic game at Hampden Park. I have to say, Hampden Park, with 12,000 fans, is the most soulless environment to play football apart from Baku. I also had the pleasure of going to the Italy-Spain semi-final, which was an absolute joy to be at. 60,000 fans. The atmosphere was fantastic. The football on display was also so joyful to watch. And I just loved the way, you know, both sets of fans mingled. There was none of the issues with such, you know, hooliganism, gate crash and things like that. It was all extremely well organised. So I think up until the final, the organisation worked perfectly well. The final kind of went badly wrong for a number of reasons, which we may be going to a bit later. But I think overall, I think most people were concerned that there'd be COVID outbreaks in camps, that players would be lost for a number of games, that the tournament would be distorted. But I think, thankfully, the protocols work quite well. So given in mind, I started watching with a degree of scepticism, I thought the whole tournament actually worked quite well.
Indeed, and it's great to have your perspective as actually having gone to it. I mean, Paul, I mean, you talked there about going to hand and it being soulless. If I jump ahead a little bit and mention Scotland, I know you didn't see Scotland play, but they technically had home advantage, but they lost both of their home games. Do you think the atmosphere-wise had an impact on that? You know, we talked prior to the tournament about how that might be a benefit to Scotland and how that might see them across the line for once, but obviously didn't turn out that way. Their only point and their best performance arguably came at Wembley.
Yeah, I think the revamped Hampden Park Stadium to me is not a football stadium. You're too far away from the action if you bought a ticket behind either of the goals. I think that having the one tier as well doesn't really work. And I can understand why the Scottish FA wants to be based there, but I think some serious work needs to be done if Hampden Park is going to be reclaim its status as an intimidating venue for visiting teams, because the days of 137,000 fans crammed onto the terraces making an absolute bear piss are long since gone. And I just think it's a very soulless design, Hampden Park. And I think Scotland might need to ask at some stage whether they switch games and maybe Tynecastle, a smaller venue, but with the crowd right close to the action. Because I just felt the Hampden Park, compared to the other, maybe the only one I would compare to is the soulless arena of Baku, which was a strange choice for the competition. But Hampden Park, I just don't get that. It's a massive advantage of Scotland playing there. And I think, bizarrely enough, at the game we were at, the Czech Republic Croatia game, there were probably more Scotland fans at that game than fans of our Croatia or Czech Republic. And we were in Glasgow Station after the game, and the number of drunks and kilts staggering around the place was actually quite frightening to behold. I think Lewis might have been one of them.
Wouldn't be surprised. He probably needed the drinks after watching some of the games. Stephen, Scribe, coming to you. I mean, Paul's alluded to it there about games in Baku and various other places. Is this a concept that we will ever see even remotely close to again? Or is this something consigned to history as a terrible, terrible idea? I guess it was exacerbated by the current situation where you can't have away fans in many of the venues. And Baku is a hugely impressive modern stadium, but there was nobody in it, which makes an absolute pointless exercise. Will we ever see the likes of this again?
Never say never, but hopefully not. I think is probably the only way I could answer that. For me, I think a major tournament like that, it needs to have no more than two hosts. It needs to have that kind of flavour to it. And then that's one of the great things about a major international tournament is whichever nation or nations host it, it has that flavour, it has that aura about it throughout all the games. Whether it's it can be the temperature and the conditions and everything involved in it. I just think that this didn't really feel like a tournament for so many reasons. There were some great stories in there. It was a tournament of convenience, going way, way back before COVID. Michel Platini's handling of the host nations for the 2016 and 2020 European Championships were, epically, epically fudged. And this brought us to this situation, then exacerbated by COVID. A lot of football played over a huge landmass to see only, eight teams exit from the initial group stages. So much was unsatisfactory about it. Yet there were some great things in it. Denmark's run to the semi-final was just, I think the best part of that tournament. I mean, I'll always have a soft spot for Italy winning the tournament, because Italy are just, Italy will be Italy, because they have that concept of either being there at the business end or shooting themselves in the foot. Italy are always brilliant, brilliant, brilliant value in major tournaments. But, yes, this tournament, it lost something by being so all over the place. It needs to have that identity. It will, I think, it'll look back as saying, well, it was a tournament without a specific identity, because it just didn't have that. A pan-European feel just does not permit in the way that European Championships of the past, 1992 felt very Swedish, 1988 felt entirely West German. And apart from the winner, Euro 84, you can feel the French. You can feel how Gallic it seems. You just look back at those tournaments, and for me at least, I can summon up the way that they felt, and I doubt that I can ever summon up the way this one will have felt, whether that's 5, 10, 15 years from now.
Yeah, and I guess if particularly the latter stages had any feel about them, it was an English feel. Coming to you, Stephen, on this. I mean, get carried away, I guess, following England as it got towards the denouement, only to sadly disappoint as ever. I mean, you've followed England to a tournament before. Now, I know this is a completely different ball game. You, You went to Brazil, the World Cup in 2014, I believe. Followed England there, where they had rather less success there than they did this year. But in terms of atmosphere and tournaments, on a wholly different experience, I'm quite sure. But the latter stages, if anything, semi-finals and final, when far more fans were allowed in and the atmosphere built, and yeah, sure, on the final there were various mismanaged, terrible problems on the day. But I guess if we're talking any bit of tournament feel, the latter stages was the only little bit that had it.
Yeah, and you say mismanaged there. I think you're being polite. These things seem to happen an awful lot when England fans are involved. Let's not get away from that. But just going back to what Steve said, I think that it had lost something before it started, in that it lost something from its fabric. You know, you all the major tournaments, and part of the build-up is always about the host country. You know, there's documentaries about the host country on TV, the logos and the flags, and everything's built up around a theme. I remember really vividly the Japan and South Korea 2002 World Cup. You know, the old flavour, I think that introduced me. I'll have only been 16 at the time. That sort of introduced me to a culture almost, in a way that I'd never looked into it before. And I think that can happen a lot, especially with FIFA's especially insistence on going to sort of far-flung places now. I know that there's alternative theories on why they do that, but in terms of growing the game and spreading the game, I can see why. To concentrate on a particular country or two countries at a time, I think that's great. I think that's the way it should be. As it's turned out, this experiment, which I think was always going to be a poor one, I think it were always never going to be popular, it might have actually worked better because of COVID rather than having one country. You know, I mean, if one country could have turned into a real hub, couldn't it? And there'd been no way of knowing what state that country were going to be in with COVID at that time. That could have completely affected it with a day's notice almost. So I think that having the flexibility of this moving feast of a tournament just gave them some options that they wouldn't have had. So I think we talk about how history will remember it. I think there's always things that come into your mind when you think of one particular tournament. I think this will be the one where people just think, oh yeah, the one where COVID and flying around all over, haphazard. I mean, I had colleagues at work who were running into work one day saying, I've just found out I've been given tickets to a game that they didn't know that they'd had the day before, because they'd suddenly had the game had been moved and the allocation had been upped. And, you know, and they're all having to book 2 days off at zero notice, you know, and all this were going on just because of the nature of it. It just felt so haphazard. And I think UEFA have kind of got away with it because of COVID. I think Paul used the word sympathetic, and I think that's quite a good point as well. But with England doing well, I think we all sort of really got into the spirit of it. I know I did, certainly going into knockout rounds. And you just said that the football was actually excellent. There was some superb football. I think that also covered up the cracks. And the knockout games, there were some fantastic games, some fantastic goals. And as I say, I think that ultimately got UEFA out of jail a little bit.
As someone who's followed England then, Stephen, what did you make of them in the end? You know, Southgate's had criticism on one hand for not being adventurous enough, you know, making the most of the huge array of attacking young talent that he's got. And yet, up until the very end, I guess, the decisions that he made, he got, well, whether they're right or not, they worked, and got England to the position where they were just a couple of spot kicks away from lifting a trophy, which, you know, no one else has done that in a long, long, long time. So what did you make of England?
No, unfortunately, I've got a bit of an unpopular opinion, and that's that I think he got it wrong, and I'm sorry. Like, I know they got to the final. I know that it were penalties, but there's no hindsight from me at all in this. I was saying it to friends and colleagues the whole way through, we weren't going to win the tournament playing like that. And what was more frustrating for me, as you say, I've been such a big England fan for so long, followed them all over through a really fallow period, hoping and praying for a Jadon Sancho and a Phil Foden to come along and a Jack Grealish or, you know, these type of players, and then we get them and we just leave them on the bench. I think especially in the first four or five matches, he played probably the only not against Ukraine. The fullbacks played with the handbrake on. Luke Shaw still got forward and did really well, but Kyle Walker really played with the handbrake on. And I think for me, if you're playing with two older midfielders, I didn't mind that, especially didn't mind it because they both played so well and they played so well together. For me, that gives them fullbacks license. Yeah, maybe it would have been different if we'd have had Trent playing rather than Kyle Walker. Kyle Walker seems to have almost turned his game around 180 degrees at one point. He was flying up and down, spent more time in the opposition half than did his own, and almost seemed like a little bit of a liability defensively. Now he seems solid as a rock defensively, but does seem to play with that handbrake on a little bit. And I think Gareth liked that in him, urged him to do that, it seems. And probably on the left-hand side, with playing Trippier in the opening game against Croatia, again with the two olders, we seemed really defensive there, played well, got away with it, sort of staved off that criticism that were inevitably going to come. But as I say, the players that didn't get the opportunity, and then I thought it was terrible to then, with 2 minutes to go of the old tournament, these players who you've hardly shown any interest in, hardly shown any faith in, to then throw Marcus Rashford on at right back, tell him, please don't make a mistake and concede a goal, but make sure you score your penalty after I haven't trusted you the whole game. I just didn't agree with that. You know, you put them on with half an hour to go at the start of extra time, say, go and win it, lads. Oh, by the way, if you don't, you're my best penalty takers anyway. But I think to put that extra pressure on them with that, you know, there was something just so deja vu, and it's deja vu on top of deja vu these days. I think when they were 1-0 up so early and playing so well, and I thought they had Italy by the throat, to then it just seemed to happen about the half-hour mark. It was like a conscious decision that they made collectively, right, we're just going to sit back now. And as soon as that decision was made, I felt it watching it on TV.
It was like the Croatia semi-final 3 years before.
Yeah,
that's
what I meant by deja vu, but then I realised that I said that then, because it had been deja vu. It's just this mentality that we've got. It's this fear of losing. And we did come so close, and I would have been so proud. I'm so proud of them as a team. The way they handled themselves off the pitch, the way Gareth handles himself off the pitch. It don't matter how many mistakes he makes on the pitch for me. He can have the job for the next 10 years because he's a better statesman than any of our actual statesmen. So, and is brave to stand up to them in the way that he does on the topics that he does. Love the guy to bits, but I do think he is far too pragmatic with, as far as I'm concerned, football, you play to your strengths. I think we had the second best squad of attacking players and creative players after France. France went out pretty early. That makes us the best team attacking and creative wise. To not use them is giving something back to the opposition, as far as I'm concerned. I think that's what we did. We give the opposition a chance in every game except Ukraine, where we put them to the sword. For me, I think if we'd used as tools properly, would have stood a better chance of actually lifting the trophy.
Well, speaking of France, and Paul, just quickly on them before we move on. They, as Stephen says there, they, you know, talent-wise, like we talked before the tournament, didn't we, about how strong they were, how highly fancied they were. What on earth happened there? I mean, they only won one game out of four. Complacency seemed to set in deeply in the Switzerland game, having got themselves back from the brink. A goal down, a penalty down, and potentially out of sight, but coming back to 3-1 with some fabulous goals and wonderful attacking play, to then almost switch off and think the job's done. Having also failed against Hungary in the groups and against Portugal in the groups, not all they were cracked up to be.
No, I think of all the teams that participated in the Euros, they were the most... They were the most frustrating to watch because at times they played, you know, they played some good football, particularly when they took the lead against Switzerland 3-1. That goal from Pogba to put them 3-1 up was, you know, it was a fantastic goal. But I agree with you, Aidan. I think complacency kind of set in for France. I was trying to think of a comparison, really, but I kind of thought it was a bit like, I think the French, always think footballing-wise, I understand why they think that, they're far superior to Switzerland. I would always expect to be Switzerland on any given day. And I kind of thought of an analogy where maybe it's like England maybe playing, I don't know, I would say Northern Ireland, who are on a fantastic run, and they got through to that stage of the competition. We go 3-1 up. And thinking that's it, we always beat these anyway. And then suddenly start messing around, switch off, and suddenly they come back to draw the game. So, I mean, the French blew their opportunity. I mean, they've just seen Italy wouldn't have lost that game against Switzerland 3-1. They would have just seen the match out. So, and given France's record of winning major competitions in recent years, you know, you do wonder whether there's more friction now between the manager and the players compared to what it used to be. Mbappe, for me, was a major disappointment in this tournament. I just didn't think he lived up to his potential at all. So I think, you know, if you're a French supporter, you'd have a lot of questions to ask about the management of the team. And, you know, I think Steve alluded to there about, you know, Southgate came up the competition well, apart from maybe one or two decisions in the final. I suppose, realistically now, I guess the French would stick with Deschamps until, you know, Qatar next year. But if they don't do well in Qatar next year, then I can see his tenure being extremely limited.
Yeah, I think he suffers from similar to what Stephen was saying about Southgate in terms of not getting the best out of a huge array of attacking talent because he's innately conservative, I think. And that's holding back in some ways. But he did win a World Cup after all, so maybe he's doing something right.
I suppose the other question as well is the return of Benzema. I mean, did that have a negative or positive impact on the squad, because it was all kind of a very last minute when he was brought back into the team, and you never quite know what the reaction was behind the scenes for his inclusion. Whether it had an effect on France, I don't know, but it'd be interesting to find out in a few years' time.
Certainly will, but that's enough of looking back. Now let's look forward. The Premier League, of course, is underway. We're a couple of weeks into the season as we record. Before we get into talking about the main contenders, I just want to talk a bit about crowds. I mean, we talked about the crowds in the Euros there and how it gradually ramped up in certain venues. But obviously in the Premier League, we're back to full stadiums. You know, real noise, real atmosphere, nothing piped in, nothing fake, none of that. It's all quite a change. It looks quite odd and feels quite odd to me, having observed it through television, compared to how the last year and a half has been. It seems a bit odd, but I know that, Stephen, you've been along to Anfield recently. How was that experience, particularly having not been for so long? And, you know, was it just simply a joyous thing all round, or was it slightly weird and odd?
Having gone to the Liverpool game yesterday at Anfield, as a comparison to everything else that had been before, it was quite surreal being back in a full stadium. It was almost like an emotional moment, really. You know, because I took my dad with me, and you know he's nearly 83 now, and he actually turned around and said, "I didn't think I'd be in a football stadium again." You know, and you know, so when he said that, I think I was quite taking it in my stride almost, only for it to kind of, I don't know, it caught up with me a little bit. It was an odd one because of the technology as well that's involved in getting to Anfield now. Everything's downloaded to your phone and there's a certain way of doing it. I was in the ground like an hour before kickoff, which is very unusual for me. And it was odd because I was sat there and I was looking at my phone. I was turning around, chatting to people I'd not seen for ages. And then suddenly I turn around and there's kind of like a full stadium or two thirds full. And it's it was a bit of a shock, you know, to see this thing that you've just not seen for like nearly 18 months. And it really kind of like, you know, it was quite a stunning sight, really. So compared to what I'd gotten for the last 16 to 18 months, this was kind of like, as I don't, it was almost like getting into a time machine and suddenly being dropped back into, you know, where we were, except, you know, it isn't, and here it is now. So it was great. It was emotional, but it was also quite surreal. And what's gone before, you know, it's utterly incompare, you know, you can't compare it to anything that we've lived through. You know, people have been here and done it before, but you know, they're not with us now. you know, this is something that probably our grandchildren and great-grandchildren might never live through. You know, the extraordinary times, and then suddenly to have this, I don't know, this event that is very normal. So, you know, that horrible phrase of the new normal, you know, here is a dose of the old normal. And it was intoxicating in a way.
Oh, it's kind of comforting to hear, isn't it? How positive the whole thing is after everything that's gone before. And Paul, have you been along to Goodison this season? I know you went in the interim last December or so, when there was a brief period where a number of people were allowed in and you'd gone along then, which is obviously a strange experience. Have you been along to the full stadium as well now?
Yeah, well, I'm a season ticket holder, so and by the way, Steve, delighted to hear you. That was at the game as well. That must have been a wonderful experience for the two of you to be there together again.
It was great. It was really good.
No, delighted to hear that, Steve. It was the first time I was going to ask you actually whether your father beamed you not. So I'm delighted to hear that you went to the game with you. So I went to Southampton game. And Stephen touched on the technology issue. I mean, this has been a bit of a burning point amongst Everton fans because you had to pay £5 to have an ordinary season, plastic season ticket card. And most people know the club's experience with technology in the past went for the season tickets. Lots of people opted for the technological on your phone season ticket, but having all sorts of issues right until the day before. When miraculously, it all came together and all worked really well. I was like, Stephen, I mean, I got to the ground at 2:00, which is really unusual for me because I had no faith in the systems working on the day. And of course, Everton kind of scared everyone beforehand by saying there'll be checks on your app to make sure you're being double vaccinated. You need to do a lateral flow test. Now, my son who comes with me, he's 20, so he had to do a lateral flow test. And there had to be rigorous checking procedures. I was walking towards the stadium. This guy stops me with a clipper and goes, "Have you been double vaccinated?" I said, "Yeah, okay." And that was it. That was the check. And so went to the stadium. And of course, the club had said beforehand, it's all card payments only, no cash. Go to get my program. Oh, the card machine's not working, mate. You've got to pay cash today. Brilliant. You know, fortunately, I brought cash with me because I just didn't trust the system to work on the day. Yeah, I mean, Stephen outlined the atmosphere there really, really well. I mean, one of the first things I did was look around because the part of the ground I sit in, there are quite a few older Everton fans there. And your first thought is, have they got through the pandemic okay? And you're really relieved to see that they had. So it was good from that point of view. Before the game started, Everton put on the screen before the match started the names of all the Everton fans who died during the interim period, and that was quite emotional. I was almost quite close to tears seeing the names, because I knew one or two people on that list as well. So I'm sure lots of people really felt that got to them personally. And the roar when the game started, well, you know, I haven't experienced something like that since the mid-80s when we were good. So it was quite touching, and the whole thing worked really well. It was good to be back, and you know, as Stephen said before there, it's strange to compare it with what went before, because what we went, that lifestyle we had before has kind of been taken away from us. So I was trying to think, you haven't been to your place of work for 2 years, and suddenly you come back in again after 2 years and you look around and so-and-so still there. What's changed? What's the new systems here? So it almost felt like that to some extent. And the one thing that really struck me on the day, which isn't particularly COVID related, but was how much as a fan I'm going to miss Goodison Park when we move.
Oh, I'd agree with that. As a supporter across the other side of Stanley Park, I'm, you know, gonna miss Goodison Park hugely. You know, it's one of the great cathedrals of you know, English European football, and you know, with so many grounds at Highbury was another one, Main Road, you know, the Dell even, you know, the certain grounds that I don't know if you go to year on year on year. And you know, you know those streets, and you know that chippy that's on the corner. You know that, you know that fanzine seller that's always on that specific spot, and all of that. It's, you know, I'm, you know, even as a Liverpool fan, I'm dreading the day that Goodison's gone.
Yeah, but you know what you just described there, Stephen. That's the problem, is it's got a soul. And that's why they're getting rid of it, because, you know, that's the nature of football now, isn't it? You know, we'll get rid of the personality and the history and the everything else that people love about it. But yeah, there you go.
And there's been several other clubs who've considered doing what Everton are doing now, and thankfully, in some cases, changed their mind. I mean, Liverpool, I'm sure, were looking at alternatives at one point. My club, Newcastle, certainly have done and opted to revamp the existing stadium instead. I know Everton have been, this has been mooted for Everton for quite some time, and it's never quite got to the point it's clearly at now, where it's definitely happening and it's on the way. But it'll be interesting, you know. I mean, you trade in the history and the soul, I suppose, for better facilities and ideally greater prospects, you know, whatever financially, earnings and fan experience and all that kind of thing. But it'll be interesting to see how that pans out in the end, because for some it's worked well and for others it hasn't. So we'll see how it goes for Everton. But if we move on to the contenders for this season, then, you know, there's been all sorts of high profile signings by some of the title contenders. Jack Grealish, £100 million, Lukaku, similar fee to Chelsea, and Man United, Stephen, have done quite well in the transfer business as well. They've got Jadon Sancho from Dortmund, of course, and Rafa Varane coming in from Madrid. What do you make of your club's prospects for the year ahead, given last season, potentially? I mean, we talked earlier in the season last year about things not going so well, I recall. And then they upturned more or less as soon as we'd finished recording. it was quite good from then on. Obviously, you finished second in the league, which, considering where most people probably thought Manchester United were, is a good achievement, even if you were looking at the heels of probably a team you didn't want to be looking at in front of you. But what do you make of this season being able to build on that finish, given the arrivals that have come in?
I do think that they'll kick on this season. I think the sort of signings, Sancho and Varane, sort of signings that United haven't been able to make recently, because they've been having to work in a different market, because they haven't been able to guarantee Champions League football and haven't been able to guarantee even pitching eye for trophies and silverware and even the way the club's run. I think it just lost its aura as a major club. It's difficult to know what the feeling like that is overseas, but certainly domestically, you know, it's Old Trafford had lost its aura. People came there expecting to be able to turn United over. I think as a club, they just lost the traditions and the soul a little bit. They lost the history. And it took a long time from Glazers coming in for that to filter down onto pitch. But I think eventually it did. And it was costly. It was costly to me as a fan. So I'm sure it was costly to a lot of people as fans. In fact, I know it was. And I just think that they've got that back the right way now. They tried getting it back the shortcut way. You know, the Mourinho way, short-term gain, short-term success, mercenary-type players. But they seem to be turning it around in the right way now, using the United traditions, using the youth particularly. I think Sancho's a fantastic signing. I haven't seen that much of him, obviously, with him being out in Germany, but what I've seen, I've loved for a long time. And then through him not playing at the Euros, I was really banging his drum at the Euros, saying we should be playing him. We're the only player. For me, out of that attacking plethora of talent that we had, that played week in, week out on the right-hand side for his club side and played well and dynamic, the sort of player that really can change the pace of the game in the right direction when you need him to, really frightens the opposition. And he does that by getting down whitewash a lot and then cutting inside further up the pitch rather than cutting inside too early and then playing in Midland Park. And so I was really beating his drum, even though he weren't playing, for him to get a chance. So I became a bigger fan of Jadon Sancho through him not playing, almost, because it was like this elusive talent that I was really wanting to see play for England. So when United signed him mid-tournament, that was great. I thought that was fantastic. And then he did get his chance and played really well. The Varane signing came out of nowhere for me. I thought United was sort of being used as a little bit of a pawn for him in contract negotiations and one thing and another. When I heard through Grapevine that it were all but done and he were actually coming, I was quite shocked and surprised. But I think that's one of the final pieces of the jigsaw, certainly in the starting 11. I think they could do with another solid central midfielder. But I think other than that, the 1-11 is not far off as strong as what there is out there now. Certainly the strongest United have had for a long time. I think the league is City's to lose and will be while ever they've got this sort of money to splash about and that manager that really attracts them players. It's always going to be City's to lose, and, you know, it'd take somebody having a fantastic almost a generation, a surge like Liverpool had, where they just got that much momentum and that fantastic team spirit. And it'll take that again, I think, to topple City now. But United are almost in that, in a genesis of that now, I think, I hope. So yeah, it certainly, for the first time in a long time, there's definite light at the end of the tunnel.
We mentioned there about the spending power of Man City. Now, Paul, I know this isn't your club, but I'll come to you anyway, because then I'll come to Stephen on his club as a title contender. You and me have to sit out this bit from our own perspectives, Paul. But in terms of the spending power that Man City has shown, but it's not just them, Chelsea as well, splashed 100 million or so on Lukaku with instant dividends today in their win this weekend. 100 million for Grealish so far, and potentially far more than that on Harry Kane if that comes to pass. I mean, maybe it will, maybe it won't. Is this showing the power of the top end of the Premier League, or is it the power, I guess, of some of the Super League wannabes that they're possibly, well, I don't know, contrasting hugely with other elite clubs in some other countries, Spain most notably, where years of financial mismanagement is coming home to roost, and they just don't have this financial might. PSG is probably the exception internationally, but is the top end of the Premier League now sat almost on its own in terms of this colossal spending power?
Is that for me, Payne?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. It's a good, really good point, that, because of, I mean, you know, let's not forget, money's always dominated football. I say, even the 60s, money dominated football. You know, teams bought their way to success. So I think it always has been. I think the difference now is, when you've got two teams in particular, Manchester City and PSG, who are backed by countries, then that really leaves the rest of the rest of us really struggling to try and play catch up or keep up there. And it was so refreshing when Leicester won the league 4 or 5 years ago, because that was totally unexpected and gave everybody hope. I think that window of opportunity has now been firmly closed, and I think there's less and less chance now of a team like Leicester coming from nowhere to win the Premier League. In terms of where at least sort of the main contenders at the moment, I mean Chelsea also seems to have limitless pockets, even though they're not actually owned by a country, You wonder, even can the Glazers' wealth or finance or overdraft compete with what the Qatari, you know, what can be offered at Man City? I don't know. It's just I've always had a few reservations about Pep Guardiola. I think it's, just to be able to buy the best players whenever you feel like buying them and bring them into the team is, it's not the most demanding of a task compared to building up a team from nothing, bringing youngsters through, bringing homegrown talent through. So I do have some concerns about, all the best players being attracted to the club with the most money. I mean, part of me doesn't understand why City bought Jack Grealish. Why they bought Jack Grealish? Because I just don't see what he brings to the team compared to what they had before. I think I'm having to live now at a time in my life when success for my team is a run to the Europa Conference League and an open top tour bus if you finish seventh in front of celebrating fans, ecstatic with that prospect. So it's just, compared to the football I grew up watching, the lack of competition, the lack of opportunity for the teams who haven't got that over finance. You do wonder, longer this continues, then the resurrection of the ESL is a definite possibility, if not a certainty.
Yeah, exactly. That will rear its head again at some point. But another of the top contenders, and we mentioned them already in terms of how their terrific run was two seasons ago now to the title. Didn't quite live up to that last season for various reasons. But I guess Liverpool are the exception at the top end of the Premier League, Stephen, in that they haven't really invested heavily this summer. Certainly nothing like any other top teams. But what they do have is a lot of returning players from significant injury. Virgil van Dijk, key among that. How do you see Liverpool's prospects this season?
Same as last season, the season before, the last two or three seasons now. I always say what Liverpool are capable of, it tends to be bridging the chasm between what the team can do and what the team will do. They can go out and win the Premier League title this season. they can go out and win the Champions League this season. You know, it's turning that can into will. You know, that's what it was two seasons ago. And winning the Champions League as well in 2019, it was a case of that. It comes down to a certain force of will, you know, to make it happen. And that's what Klopp's Liverpool tends to be about. It's the force of will and personality to make it happen. They've got more than enough talent to do so. You know, it is having that insistence and persistence to say this is going to happen. You know, Klopp's Liverpool are all about kind of like, you know, not asking but taking, you know, and that's what they do. And you know, it takes at the same time. It takes a lot out of a team. It takes a lot out of individuals. And Klopp's Dortmund was very similar in that respect, is that they had this propensity to have players would burn out and they would eventually have to be moved on. But you know, the Liverpool squad seems to manage to keep pace with the manager. And it is all about the eye of the storm for Liverpool. You know, they can conjure up that type of magic again, providing they've got both the physical and mental durability for it.
Well, we will see how it goes for them. And contrasting to the fortunes of these at the top, there's a couple of other of the bigger sides who are not doing so well. Certainly Arsenal are having a terrible time at the start of the season. Mikel Arteta seems to be the favourite in the sack race already, which is quite something for a team of that stature. Spurs, I guess their local rivals are another one who we're unsure at this stage how it's going to go for them, given nobody seems to know whether Harry Kane is going to be there by the end of this month or not. A little hard to judge, but these are both clubs, Stephen, come to you, that were hoping to be in a different stratosphere by this stage. You know, they both were part of the Super League campaign last season in terms of that fall breakaway. They're clubs who clearly have the resources and the fan base and the will, I guess, to be a level above most of the rest of the league. But certainly in Arsenal's case, it's not happening now. I mean, I presume it's a temporary blip for them, but similar was said at some stages last season when they were struggling. Is Mikel Arteta the problem, do we think? Is this something that is more fundamental with the squad, or is it just a cyclical thing that they need to come again?
I think it's the club from top to bottom. Arsene Wenger took so much of the blame for so long in that, and I think that he's almost been vindicated in everything that he did and said over them years. You know, you go back to the Arsenal leaving Ibury and going to the Emirates, you know, this was meant to be the dawning of the new club that they were. And it just never panned out. It never turned out to be that. You know, there's so much being said, and correctly so, about the amount of money that those fans pay for the tickets. I just don't know how they justify that. As a business, well, not only they justify it as a business, I don't know how they justify it as a football club. Spurs, I think, is slightly different. That's Daniel Levy. They never, I know they've moved to the new stadium now, but they certainly didn't do it. They got to that big club status organically, and I really respected Spurs for how they got there and what they did to get there. But they seem to have stalled as they've been going forward. Whereas Arsenal just seem to have fallen away and never managed to turn the ship around in the other way. And it's almost like they're now settling for that. I think that's the most frustrating thing for Arsenal fans. They just seem to have slowly turned into a mid-table club, and it's as though they've got no idea how to get back out of that. They can't compete with the spending of the truly big clubs. And the problem that they've got is, and what I can see happening now, particularly in the Premier League, or well, only really in the Premier League, is because of the TV money. You've got your Man City, who've got this unbelievable wealth, who are always going to be able to spend more than anybody else. The TV influx that's been shared out so equally between the clubs has kind of leveled the playing field a little bit. And I think that's where Arsenal, as just a big club, one of the big clubs, would always come back. It would just be cyclical. And they'd only be out of the pitch for two or three years, maybe while they had a rebuilding process. Now, all the clubs that they're now in that pot with, fighting for a top six position, fighting for a top eight position, I just don't see how they're going to drag them. They've got nothing going for them from top to bottom, on the pitch, off the pitch, that makes me think that they're going to be a team that manages to be perennially above Leicester again, or perennially above Everton again, or West Ham. All these clubs now, they've all got money to spend. They've all got the financial power to hold on to their players rather than sell them on, or certainly they've got the ability to hold on for as much as they possibly can. Arsenal and Spurs are now, I fear, and it's what I was afraid were happening to United, and I think I've managed to turn that round. They've fallen into a place where it's difficult to get out from. I think Chelsea have obviously managed to do it as well. Liverpool never quite got there. Liverpool never dropped below that in recent years. So I think that's where your top four comes from now. And I think everywhere else, almost from top to bottom, your promoted teams don't get chance to integrate that, I don't think, fully until they've been there quite a few years. But, you know, you look at your Southamptons, Crystal Palace, the starting 11s, there's not much in them anymore, even if you pick an Arsenal or a Southampton starting 11, a West Ham or a Spurs starting 11. Now you're not seeing as much difference, there's not as big a difference between them from top to bottom. And I think that's why Arsenal and Spurs are going to I'm afraid probably going to be also runs again.
Well, one of the crowd, along with the likes of Everton, potentially. Paul, now speaking of your club, big change at the helm this summer. Haven't heard too much about it. Not a controversial character in Everton at all. So Rafa Benitez then, obviously Liverpool legend, won the Champions League, drove the club onto big success. Not being universally accepted in Everton initially, fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was never going to be universally accepted, was it? I mean, it's probably similar to Steve Bruce moving to Newcastle with the Sunderland connections. You know, you just have to take a pragmatic approach and just accept what the reality is. I think that despite all the headlines, you know, that are grabbed by the Cyprus fans claiming, you know, they're never going to watch Everton again and why Benitez is the manager. The reality is most fans have quietly come to terms with the fact that he's the manager and have quietly checked his record and thought, actually, this guy's not too bad, you know. He's done quite well at most of the clubs he's been in charge of. And I think there's also an acceptance that during the summer there wasn't a great deal of managerial talent out there to go looking for. I mean, when a sort of likes a Graham Potter being touted for the job, well, Graham Potter or Rafa Benitez, for me, there's no choice. It's Benitez, isn't it? And I think so far, he's made all the right steps. What's been quite fascinating to watch is, I mean, certainly last year, there was just this acceptance that Carlo Ancelotti as the Messiah was, you know, you couldn't question any of his decisions. And when you think we lost 11, 12 games at home last season, that would not have been tolerated in front of fans, that level of performance. And so questions weren't getting asked last season about how we were playing. Now, obviously, questions are going to get asked now more about Benitez, but I think one thing about Rafa Benitez is, and you know this from your time at Newcastle, is he knows his tactics, he knows how to set teams out, he knows how to prepare for matches. I remember when he was appointed as Napoli manager, and in his first press conference, he said something like, I've been asked more questions here about tactics in the first 5 minutes than I was asked in five seasons in England. So tactics is really his thing. So the first two games have gone well. I mean, sadly, the big test will be the derby in November against Liverpool. Now, thankfully, that's not at Anfield, because, you know, if that were to be a catastrophic defeat, which it quite often has been so recently, that would have a massive impact. But I think given the first derby, I think all he has to do is not lose at Goodison. If he comes away with a 0-0 draw, I think that will convince the doubters. And yeah, I mean, it was the popular choice, but I did. I was going for a walk with my wife and son about 3 or 4 weeks ago. We don't live too far from where Carlo Ancelotti lived in Liverpool, in a place called Blundell Sands, which is too far from us. And there were two removal vans outside his enclosed house with the Spanish mudanzas on the side and the Madrid address. And I was really tempted to get my knife out and slash the tires, but fortunately, I decided against that. But it just kind of hit home the reality. But I think most Everton fans have been extremely frustrated by the way Ancelotti treated the club, despite all the things he said. And I've kind of come to the conclusion that, do you actually have to like the club manager? Does it matter?
Does it matter? No. If they deliver success, not at all. Yes, I mean,
exactly.
What you said there about Benitez, and you're absolutely right. He knows how to set a team to get the best out of them, or to prevent the other team showing their superiority, which it can be. And that was often what he had to do at Newcastle a lot, and he did it quite well. I'll come to you, Stephen, though, for a Red perspective on this. Obviously, a lot of history with Benitez at your club. But I guess one thing he's shown over the years, he's never afraid of a challenge. He's not afraid of taking on a difficult situation. He was interim manager or whatever title he had at Chelsea, and was universally loathed by their fan base because of the history of the European Cup semi-finals, I guess, between your club and theirs, that he'd won through on both occasions. But he wasn't popular there, and yet he still succeeded and delivered them silverware despite all the extra attention that seemed to have been brought upon himself merely by choosing to go there. And I guess it's a similar situation now. What's your perspective on this move?
My perspective is, Benitez as a manager, he's a fantastic manager, that he has this wonderful ability to kind of create expansive football teams, but within, I don't know, almost like a pragmatic approach. He's not pragmatic. He doesn't preach a pragmatic style of football, but he is pragmatic in the way that he coaches and manages his teams. He does the basics very, very well. And his teams will go out and play some very good football, but it's very structured. And, there is a pattern and a method to it. Some of the best football, some of the best footballing days of my life have been watching a Benitez side, Istanbul, Cardiff, all sorts of places. I don't begrudge him taking the job one little bit. He's been offered a very good Premier League job on his own doorstep. He'd have been mad to turn it down. So for me, I've no bones of contention with him at all. It certainly does not, cloud my feelings about Benitez and those years that he was Liverpool manager. The great thing about Benitez is that, he will, and he said it himself, he will fight for, his employers. He will fight for the club that he is the manager of. And he'll be exactly the same at Everton. He will do his best by Everton. The acid test is always going to be, I think, as Paul said, the derby will be a big thing for him. But I think probably bigger will be that first downturn in results. There will be a sticking point at some point where, maybe they don't pick up a win in 5 or 6, and it's how the reaction, goes to that. Now, I think this is a fantastic opportunity for Everton. If Benitez was to turn around and be Everton's first trophy winning manager in, 26, 27 years, then, he should be as fated on the blue side of Merseyside than he is on the red. Aidan, you know from your experience of his Newcastle, as exactly the type of manager that Benitez is and what he can give. But he is also a manager that, although he's blinkered and very, very focused, as seen with that spell at Chelsea, he does also thrive on the support and the love of the crowd. He thrived at St. James Park. He thrived at Anfield. He floundered at Inter. He floundered in Madrid. But even then, floundered in Madrid, he was sacked 2 weeks after putting 10 goals past Rayo Vallecano. Benitez is one of these characters that needs to be understood by his employers, and then secondary by the supporters. If the club gets him and figures out what he wants to do and gets the project, then, that's great. That's the be-all and end-all in that respect. See his time at Valencia for that. That famous quote about how, he said what type of players and what position of players he needed. But then he described Valencia's actions as being, I asked for a table, they brought me a lampshade, a stand lamp. It's all of that type of thing for Benitez. If Everton buy into what Benitez's vision is, and he will have a vision for Everton, if the club buy into it and the supporters can bubble along with him, I think this is a fantastic opportunity for Everton.
Well, we'll see how that one goes across the season, of course. Now, a little further down the table, well, two of the three teams who came up were two who went down the year before, in Norwich and Watford. So the league has a very familiar look about it. The exception being Brentford. Now, this is a club I eulogise for a moment. It's quite dear to me from my time living around the corner in West London from Brentford. I went along on a number of occasions to their old stadium at Griffin Park. It's a great community club. It does things a little differently under their enigmatic coach, Thomas Frank. You know, they kind of have to do things differently given their location. You know, they're so close to Chelsea, so close to Fulham, who've been well above them in recent years. So the catchment area they're in not just in terms of fans, but in terms of how they run their squad, academy-wise and things like that, they're just not going to get the players from that locality that Chelsea are able to, for example. So they had to do things slightly differently. You know, they get players rejected by other Premier League academies and then bring them through. They invest wisely. It doesn't seem to trouble them when they lose one of their top players, as they did when Ollie Watkins left, when they narrowly failed to get promoted the year before and he left for Aston Villa. But what do? They invest wisely again. They get another striker who, well, Ivan Toney was one who was at Newcastle United for a time, but never made the breakthrough there. He was much younger then, of course. But, you know, this is the type of player that Brentford identify, invest in and bring through. And it's reaping dividends. It doesn't seem to trouble them at all that they're living in a different plane to all these other clubs that they're now competing with. And yet, as they've shown already this season, they are more than capable of competing. So from a personal note, I would absolutely be delighted if they had a successful season, by which I guess success would be merely 17th, but I wouldn't be surprised if they finish higher than that as well. Which brings me on to the bottom of the table. Stephen Bell, in your case, and you don't have to mention Newcastle here, that's not required, who do you think are the contenders for the drop this year?
Unfortunately, and I think we're going to see it more and more. I mean, the yo-yo analogy has always been a thing, but I think we're going to see that more and more now because, as I said last time, the influx of the TV money for your established Premier League clubs means that they can rely on that every year, you know, and you're always going to get one or two of the established clubs getting dragged into relegation dogfight. But generally, your established clubs now that have had that influx of money for so long and have this ability to hold on to the top players for longer, it's more difficult to see a real wide open relegation battle. And I think, unfortunately, those every year now, I think we're going to see the three teams that come up, probably at least two of them be the three that go two out of the three that go down. I just think that's the way that it's going to be from now on. You know, it's difficult to see a Crystal Palace now getting dragged in. You know, I don't think Newcastle get dragged in. I know you asked me not to mention him, and I don't think I've given kiss of death, but I don't see him getting dragged into it. I think they've got a good enough squad and a good enough manager and a good enough fan base. And I just don't see it. So unfortunately for me at this stage, and I think Brentford, because of everything that you've just said, and everybody knows it, and how long they've been knocking on that door, doing things differently and doing things a way that has interested people in this era where everything's just been so much about investment. They have captured an imagination, I think, for quite a few years now. They've been knocking on that door and worked so hard at it for so long and stuck to it as well. You know, it's not like they've just thought, it's not working, we're going to try a different approach. They've stuck to it. They've got there. They've got to promised land. And I think they're going to be a lot of people's second team this year, and they're going to be the team that people hope stays up. And I hope they do. I hope they have success with it. But to answer your question, if I were putting money on it, I would say that probably the three that came up, the three favourites to go down.
Well, I'm glad you think Newcastle are going to be okay. I wish I had your optimism. Well, we'll move on from domestic matters now. And I guess it would be remiss of us not to mention one of the biggest transfer news that's happened in world football for quite some time. Lionel Messi, of course, is the man who has left Barcelona pretty much against his will, against the club's will, against everybody who was thinking it would all just work out, no matter how they worked out the wages and realised it was never going to fit the regulations. There seemed to be an assumption it was all going to work out, but he's gone to, I guess, one of only a couple of clubs that could realistically have taken him on, PSG. Paul, thoughts on this? I mean, to me, I don't find it particularly exciting. I find it a bit predictable that he's just gone to PSG and, you know, he's going to... It's almost a video game front line that he's joined now with Neymar and Mbappe. I mean, how do you feel about this transfer? To me, it's just a little bit boring, despite all the furore around it.
Yeah, I mean, I think my initial thoughts were, you know, I was actually glad to see that he left Barcelona, because the way Barcelona have kind of filled the finance over the years, the way that they've sort of bent the rules to suit their own purposes, you know, the way they've been able to, you know, finance multi mega deals without having the money to do so, and then, you know, once they realize the money's running out, they try and set up the ESL. That just really did it for me. So I've no problem. You know, I was actually quite glad to see Messi leave Barcelona. And maybe from a Barcelona point of view, it might be beneficial in that they won't be so Messi dependent in the future, because I think the last three or four seasons, there's been a real sort of perception that Barcelona are a one-man team. And I think, you know, even from Messi's perspective, you know, if you look at the collapse of the semi-final Anfield a couple of seasons ago when the people won the Champions League, for a so-called world-class player who, you know, is at the top of his game, that was an appalling way to lose a game. And even more so since he lost away to Roma in a similar situation the season before. So, you know, he's 34 now, Messi. So, you know, realistically, his peak playing days have gone. I can see why PSG wanted to buy him. You know, marketing wise, you know, he would attract sponsorship. He would attract the type of headlines that they like to look for. He will also give the owners some degree of respectability as well, which I'm sure, you know, was in their thinking. But in terms of would it make me more likely to want to watch PSG on the TV? Not particularly. I mean, one thing I did wonder about, I may be totally wrong on this, but particularly during COVID times, but no, if you live in Southern England, if you live in London, Paris is 2 hours away on the Eurostar train, isn't it? And, you know, getting tickets to PSG is quite easy, I would have thought, for pretty run-of-the-mill average matches. So, I don't know. I mean, are they hoping to tap into a Southern English market there and get people travelling across to watch Messi? I don't know. It's just a random thought, because there's clearly a marketing strategy here, because I don't quite see how he fits into their style of play particularly. And, you know, it's difficult to get excited about a player earning mega bucks moving to another club who's going to play mega bucks in another couple of years. And I think, you know, I do have some concerns about that. I just don't think in the current climate it's a particularly edifying spectacle to be involved in or to be rejoicing at.
And Stephen, with PSG then, you know, they've obviously got an eye on the Champions League and have done for some time. Do you think, though, with this signing, that they simply have to win the Champions League in this 2 year stint that he's there, given all that's surrounding it? And as a side of thought, do you think they'll win League One this year?
I think with PSG and Man City, you know, again, another one. It's as mentioned before, it's you know, backed by nations as such. You know, that they both have to win the Champions League at some point. And it will be a case of the sooner, I hate to use the phrase the sooner the better, because that it's not the sooner the better as far as football is concerned in that respect. But as far as those clubs are concerned, then, you know, these are the monkeys on their back. The monkeys on their back is the lack of winning the Champions League, despite all of the riches that they have at their disposal. So for PSG to sign Messi and even this last 3 or 4 days, talk of them trying to recruit Cristiano Ronaldo as well. You know, it's getting a little bit kind of like Harlem Globetrotter-esque. You know, I don't know, just it's almost like throwing all the paint at the easel and hoping that something sticks within the shape of the Champions League. Within that, you know, it's not a coincidence that these clubs find it hard to win the Champions League. Football, you know, I think it was Paul mentioned earlier on, that football doesn't just, despite all of the riches involved, there's more to football than simply having the biggest checkbook. You know, if it was simply down to having the biggest checkbook, then, you know, the last 10 Champions Leagues would have gone to the Parc des Princes and the Etihad, and they've not. You know, football's a thinking game as much as it is a spending game. And I think that's where PSG come unstuck. And bizarrely, I think the signing of Messi potentially makes winning the Champions League harder than easier.
And Stephen, final thought from you on this one. Like, what does this mean for Barcelona and La Liga in general? You know, it's often been seen as home for many top players in their prime, whereas possibly other leagues, Premier League included, hasn't always had the elite in their prime. I guess Messi's beyond that now, but does this damage La Liga as much as it may damage Barcelona?
I think Barcelona's current plight damages La Liga more than Messi leaving. There's something quite sinister about the Barcelona thing, because for so long they preached a bit of a holier-than-now kind of mantra, you know, not selling out to sponsors, or claiming that they weren't selling out to sponsors, and they were the people's club and the charitable club. And then, you know, all this has crawled out at woodwork. And I don't think it tarnishes Messi's legacy directly. I think he's got one of the greatest legacies of a one club player, as he was being the Barcelona player, that anybody could ever have. But if he, as is almost his wages and what they were paying him, one way or the other, has had a dramatic negative effect on that club for the foreseeable future. You know, just being so desperate to keep hold of that talisman, to the detriment of the whole rest of the playing squad, to the detriment of the books. I find the move to PSG just, I think you used the word predictable. Yeah, I think that's it. And I'll use this word soulless again. It's so, it unifies us all in that, you know, alongside Man City, I think we, you know, the clubs that we don't want to win the Champions League just for that. So, and I never thought about it that until Steve said, but it's kind of the sooner it happens, the better. Because once they've done it, they might get bored and leave. That's the only benefit to them actually winning it, I think. But up till then, it gives us all sort of a team to tribalise, if that's a word, against, you know, because it is just so. I mean, I haven't looked at the odds, but I'm sure that the favourites to win the Champions League yet again, and City will be second favourites purely because of that spending power. Barcelona have fallen away to nothing now, like I'm sure Real Madrid has. As you say, the Liga clubs are going to struggle. They'll always have the pull, I think, because of the lifestyle and the heritage. I think Barcelona, Real Madrid will still always be able to attract big players, but maybe not the biggest in their prime. You know, they were always the favourites. I know, going back to sort of Ronaldinho when United were trying to sign him, and it happened with a lot of players around that time where Barcelona, Real Madrid would pip them to the post. You know, the golden gooses at the time that were available in the transfer market would always seem to get pipped by Real Madrid and Barcelona. I think them days are probably gone now. They're probably working in a different market now. The youth setup there is obviously great. They're going to have to go back and work on that again. But that seemed to be what the perception was, that they could afford Messi because everybody else had come through the ranks and they didn't actually spend much money. But obviously, they've got themselves in a grand old mess. No pun intended. So I do think it's damaging for La Liga, but I think that's more down to Barcelona's plight than the direct Messi leaving. The Messi leaving, as you say, I mean, how much money can one person possibly need? You know, he's spoken openly about, you know, wanting to have this perfect career to look back on, and that would probably be bookended by him going back to Newell's Old Boys and that sort of thing. I mean, even Man City, I could have kind of seen a little bit more logic, a bit more of an emotional context, you know, coming to prove it in, and I don't mean that in the Premier League is the be all and end all in any way, shape or form, but it's obviously a much stronger league for him to prove himself in than League One, League One. And the being reunited with Pep would be a bit of a story. There would be a little bit more to it if he'd gone to Man City. The PSG move is just the most soulless thing that he could have done. And whilst it won't tarnish his career as probably the greatest player that's ever lived, it sort of It does for me a little bit, I'll be honest.
Okay, then, a final change of topic for us for this pod, then, a chance for you guys to set the agenda a little bit and to give us a bit of any other business or a soapbox moment to give a little rant. So, Paul, I will come to you first. What have you got for us?
Yeah, I've kind of got one bad, one good. That's okay. And so, yeah, I was really concerned this week, and particularly the news yesterday, about footballers who I've watched as a kid throughout my life coming down with dementia in increasing numbers almost week on week now. News about Dennis Law didn't actually come as a surprise because I'd seen a Sky film about a year or so ago, and he was struggling a bit then, so that announcement didn't shock me particularly. But Terry McDermott, certainly, that came absolutely out of the blue, given his age as well. So I think, when Jeff Astle's daughter first raised this about 20 years or so ago now, it kind of was not taken seriously at all. She was kind of like a lone voice campaigning. And then she's actually, I think, deserves immense credit for the way she's campaigned relentlessly to make authorities, the PFA, the football, the FA, aware of this kind of ticking time bomb, really, because the more and more players in the next few years who end up, having to come out and say they've been diagnosed with dementia. And when you watched that film, Finding Jack Charlton, and you saw the way he was towards the end of his life, it's absolutely heartbreaking. So I think that there needs to be, far more, given the riches that the Premier League generates each year, there needs to be far more money provided to care for these ex-professionals to make sure that the final years of their lives are comfortable. And there also needs to be lots of funding for research to see, is there a link between heading and dementia? If that is a proven link, then what does football do to change to make sure that doesn't impact on future generations? Because this issue is not going away, and the more and more famous footballers from our past who come out and say they come with dementia, then football is going to have to take some action. The news about Terry McDermott last night actually stunned me, because given his age, he's not even 70 yet, and he's showing the first signs of dementia. That was absolutely heartbreaking for someone who, as a player, you remember for Newcastle as well, and obviously you just have such fond memories of. Action needs to be taken and research needs to be carried out. The one good thing is, yesterday, the FA Cup preliminary round started again, and my local team, Marine, drew away 1-1 at Workington. So it's a cup replay on Tuesday night, just down the road from me at College Row. So I'll be along to watch that one. And isn't it fabulous that the team that kind of had the real romance story from football last year, we were playing Tottenham Hotspur in the third round of the FA Cup at the MTA Arena, doing the FA Cup run started again. And I can't quite see it being the same as last season, but hey, you never know.
You never know, indeed. Let's hope for the best on that front. Okay, Stephen Scragg, how about you?
I just want to give a big up for everything what Paul's just said there about dementia.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the increasing links between heading the ball and players struggling. I was only talking to someone the other day about a former Southampton player. And I don't think this is common knowledge, so I'm not going to name the player, but a former Southampton player that's in a nursing home, the same nursing home as a friend of mine's mother-in-law. It's shocking. The news of Terry McDermott's really kind of shook me today. He, as a Liverpool supporter of that 70s and 80s generation, we all had Kenny Dalglish as our idol, but we all always had a favourite player as well. So, and for me, Terry, and they tend to be midfielders, because for that midfield of McDermott, Souness, Jimmy Case and Ray Kennedy, we as Liverpool supporters would tend to have one standout favourite of those four, and McDermott was mine. Grew up on McDermott being this wonderful player and found that utterly devastating news today. Away from that, I'm going to go with the television is both, it is both annoying me and pleasing me. BT have picked up Serie A, which is brilliant, because they will just show, and they are showing so many games. There was, what, four yesterday, there's four today, and another two on Monday night. And James Richardson fronting Italian football is always going to be a wonderful thing. So that's a welcome return. But also Sky have picked up Bundesliga and they are hiding it in apps and on the YouTube channel. You know, there's been so many games this weekend, but I think they've only shown one live, I think. So, yeah, on one side of the coin, Sky are criminally downplaying the Bundesliga. But, you know, a big thumbs up for BT and their coverage of Serie A.
Great stuff. Okay, and Stephen Belt, how about you as well?
Yeah, I'd just wanted to go back and almost have a little bit of a soapbox moment about what I kind of touched on a little bit earlier, and that was that I've never actually been as proud of the England team, despite the fact that I question the tactics and everything else that went on throughout the tournament, off the pitch. Gareth Southgate and the players were just fantastic, you know, doing a better job of holding our government to account on various topics. And I think there was a period when the booing of the taking of the knee, and I know you might touch on that yourself, Aid, was gathering momentum. And it would have been easy for them to almost just shy away from it a little bit, but they didn't. Rather than that, they took the absolute lead throughout the whole tournament, you know, and pressured other teams into doing it. The real sense of pride, and what I think is that had a galvanising effect on the whole squad. You know, we've heard from various players in the past, and you can believe it as much as I love the players, Gary Neville, Steven Gerrard. We've heard it from that there was dissension. You know, they couldn't separate the animosity that they felt from the club game to come together for the big tournaments. You know, we've heard stories in the books about them sitting together at different tables, eating the meals and things like that. This team is completely different. They're all together. And I think that cause that they were fighting for and the greater good that they knew they were all fighting for had a galvanising effect on that. And I thought it was just fantastic to see. You know, there's so much to not be proud of in this country, I think, at the minute. And the England team, on and off the pitch, as it turned out, were really something to be proud of. And I think that for some reason, Calvin Phillips really stands out in my mind. I don't know why, but he, as a player who went into that, and I wouldn't have had him in my starting 11, he came out of that for me as both on and off the pitch, a real leader and a player that I'm really sort of championing now in every way possible. So yeah, just real pride really at the way that they managed that, and Gareth Southgate in particular, the statements that he made both in person and in writing before, stressing how they felt about it, that they're all in it together, and a real sense of pride and something that's going to stand us in good stead, I think.
Oh, well said, absolutely. I mean, on a similar lines, I was going to mention about the taking the knee as well, and that's from the perspective, the Millwall manager, Gary Rowett, made comments, I think last week it was, about the taking of the knee, which had been booed at Millwall when Fulham came to visit the other day. So he was claiming it was causing a rift at football between players and fans, and indeed between groups of fans, that he thinks the way to fix that would be to have a more unifying gesture instead of taking the knee, which is... It's utterly missing the point so much that it almost serves as a clear example of why people need to make this stance in the first place, just as Rashford and Sancho and Saka and the abuse they got showed, well, this is why we do it. Tyrone Mings as well, making similar points in the Euros. The gesture's not causing the rift. It's shining the light on it. And go on.
Sorry. It is, because a lot of people want the gesture changing to something that doesn't cut through. It's cutting through, and a lot of people don't like the fact that it's cutting through, and therefore they think that, oh, let's change it to a little symbol that you can barely see, that I don't have to actually, somewhere on shirt. You know, that's the sort of thing that the probably I'd prefer it to be. But the fact that it's in your face. And the other thing, you know, a lot of these people hide behind the fact that it's oh, it's just all about George Floyd. It's just one person. Well, no, it's not. Taking the knee, look at the Colin Kaepernick, the history of it all. It goes back a lot longer than that. That's a chicken and egg. So that shows the ignorance in the first place. I think, as I say, I think it's cutting through. And while ever it's cutting through, it's more of a reason to continue to do it. Sorry, Ed.
No, no, absolutely. Spot on. No, I mean, couldn't agree more. I mean, obviously, as you say, the reason for it, the meaning of it, it's been explained ad nauseam that there can't be any serious counter-argument anymore from anyone who's actually got their eyes open, linking it to a political movement. You know, players have explained it endlessly, just as Gareth Southgate did, as you talked about there, Stephen, prior to the Euros. Some people just simply don't want to listen to that or open their eyes to it. And to me, the clubs, and this could be any club, you know, Millwall's the one that's prompted this in my mind now, but that's just one incident. This could be any number of clubs, and indeed should be, they should be taking the stance in support of their own players who are choosing to make the statement, rather than the clubs then, in Gary Rout's case, making a statement, as you say there, to placate those in their fan base who seem to be offended by players taking the knee for, what, 5 or 10 seconds at the start of a game. It's incredible. And to those who feel the need to boo, booing people who are making a gesture against racism, well, in my mind, I know exactly what that makes them, no matter what they may claim. So that's where I want to end that little rant, is that these pretense at it being a anti-political thing is, well, it's laughable. I think that's what they want to believe. It's an excuse, absolutely. It's an excuse to hide what, well, what we can all see their actual feelings are. Anyway, on that note, I think we'll leave it there for tonight. So thank you very much, everybody, for your contributions this evening. It's been another great podcast. So a great one to get us back into the new season after our summer break on Today's Football Time. So thank you very much for all your contributions. Cheers, Paul.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me on the show. I always love the way you seamlessly host this show as well. And thank you for the finale as well. You've been getting that message across. I think the more people know, support that stance, then things are going to change to the better. So well done to you for that. And massive thanks well to Steve. And so I love getting their insights on football, their knowledge about football, their passion about football. Makes them both a pleasure to listen to.
Indeed it does. And yes, thank you, Stephen Scragg, for your contributions this evening.
Oh, it's great as always. A joy as always. And you know, what a way to spend an hour and a half, you know, and you've all put some brilliant stuff forward tonight, and just a joy to take part in it.
And Stephen Bell, you as well. Always great to have your perspective on issues in Manchester and beyond.
Thanks, Aid. As I've said before, it's always a pleasure, and probably saves me 50 quid on a therapy session when I come on here, because I managed to get things off my chest.
All part of the service. Well, thanks to everybody for listening to, and do join us again next time with all of our podcasts at These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.